History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold as long as people like you and me are willing to take just a couple of simple steps. First, take the initiative and ask a few questions, and then listen patiently as some of those memories, often buried for decades, start to filter their way out. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This is the first weekend in February, which by now you know is Black History Month. And if you're someone who listens to this program on a regular basis, I don't have to sell you on the value of history. Quite frequently, the stories and perspectives our veterans share on Hometown Heroes are things none of us could have ever really learned in school. The heart behind Black History Month runs through a similar vein, with an aim to open all of our eyes to achievements and experiences that we just haven't been made aware of. And there's always a story behind the story. For instance, you know Jackie Robinson was the first African-American to play in the major leagues when he broke in with the Brooklyn Dodgers. You might know Larry Doby was the first to play in the American League. But did you know that they were both among the approximately 1 million African-Americans to serve in our armed forces during World War II? A still segregated military at that. On this program, we've learned there was another future Baseball Hall of Famer who was actually offered the chance to break the color barrier first, Monty Irvin, but declined that opportunity because of how he had been affected by serving in the war. The National Football League was integrated 1 year before baseball. Jackie Robinson's former UCLA football teammates, Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, along with former Nevada Wolfpack star Marion Motley and Ohio State alum Bill Willis, broke that barrier. For Strode and Motley, that came only after their own service in World War II. It might be hard to believe that it wasn't until 1950 that black players suited up in the NBA. There were three that season, and while Earl Lloyd was too young to have served in World War II, Chuck Cooper spent the final year of the war in the Navy, and Nathaniel Sweetwater Clifton, all 6'8" of them, spent 3 years in the Army serving in the European theater. And here's a question for you to ponder when you think of the integration of those major professional sports leagues, not to mention the ultimate integration of the U.S. military under President Harry Truman in 1948. How much longer would it have taken for those groundbreaking developments to materialize without the powerful example of those 1 million African-American men and women during World War II? Not only did they help save the world with what they contributed overseas, victory for America abroad, but they really did contribute immeasurably to the other half of what you've heard called the double V, victory over prejudice and discrimination back home in the United States. Today we're going to hear the memories of two men who both went on to distinguished careers in the medical field. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius would become a trailblazing heart surgeon, while Robert Hammond would work in the preventative realm of public health and become director of environmental health for Los Angeles County. We're going to start with Hammond's story. Born to a black father and a white mother in 1926, he grew up in Philadelphia.
Right after Pearl Harbor, I became a air warden. Used to ride my bicycle around. Anyone that had lights on, we would tell them to put it out. We were kind of afraid of Hitler at the time because they used to send the Graf Zeppelin over, and it had those swastikas on it as youngsters. It would land in Lake Hood, New Jersey, and they had all these ropes and things hanging down, and somebody told us, you better run and hide because those ropes are going to come down and bring you up to that Zeppelin. They're going to carry you away. So when that thing came, we would run and hide. I was much younger then when that Zeppelin came. But I'll never forget that because that was part of what was going on in the world at the time with Adolf Hitler. He was really on the rampage at the time and doing things that was unheard of, killing a lot of people. That's how we got the stories from. We got it from the radio. When I became 17, my oldest brother, he went to West Point and became a Buffalo Soldier. Matter of fact, my great-grandfather was the bandmaster for the original Buffalo Soldiers, and my oldest brother was the last of the Buffalo Soldiers, because they disbanded that. They used to go on parade and things like that from West Point, and they disbanded that and put those men into Patton's Army. And so he went in the Army. My cousins went into the Army. My dad was gone. He had passed away years earlier. And it was just seeing uniforms. And all the guys wanted to wear a uniform. And at the time, I wanted one. After being an air raid warden and getting involved, became 17, I found out if I could go into the service at age 17, but the one that I could go into was the United States Navy. So I went down and joined the Navy and brought the papers back to get my mother to sign it. And she wouldn't sign it. And I said, well, if you don't sign it, I'll sign it for you. So she said, you really want to go? I said, yeah, nothing's going to happen to me. I'll be all right. So she signed it, and I went into the Navy. Most of my friends were Italian people, Jewish people, and Polish people. And we went to school together in Camden. And a lot of these guys, they joined the Navy too. So we got on the train, and we're going to Great Lakes. And what they did, the train went south, and as it got into Washington, D.C., they put it on the side, the train, and a conductor came through, and persons of color, you got to move to another car. So I said, I'm not moving any place. I'm staying right here. You can't make me move. So my Italian friends and everybody crowded around me, and they said, no, if he moves, we move. So they said, well, we'll get the police in here and lock all of you up. I said, well, we don't care. We're going to war anyway. And I said, yeah, I might as well die here than die overseas. I said, matter of fact, what's going on? And then they came in and said, well, you're down south now, and you crossed the Mason-Dixon line, and we don't mix. At that time, they called us colored. Yeah. They don't mix colored and white together anywhere in the south. And that was brand new to me. And it was also new to my friends. Well, we grew up together, went to school together and things like that, played ball. And they weren't going to take any stuff about all that segregation and Jim Crowism that they had in the South. So we stayed in that car. They just locked the doors on us. Wouldn't let anybody in there. So the car went through D.C., went through Virginia, and got over into, I think it was Ohio. And that's when they didn't say anything. They came through and said, oh, you guys can go wherever you want. They unlocked the doors. On the way to Great Lakes, when we got there, this is in the winter, around December 14th or 15th is when I got in the Great Lakes. I had on an overcoat, two pairs of pants, a wool sweater. And when I got there, we had to stand in line outside in the cold for about 2 hours to get into camp. A man in front of me, he was just freezing. He came from the deep south, and he was cold. So I took off a pair of pants and gave it to him and gave him my sweater so he could stay warm. And then they marched us over to a place where it was late at night, and we went to bed. And the next morning was pure hell that we had to go through at that camp, because this is when they sent all the white guys to one camp and all the colored guys or black guys to another camp. And I didn't understand that. I said, this is the United States Navy, and they separating us? Why? And I asked the officer, why are you doing that? He said, just shut the... Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. And I didn't say any more. And they sent me to a place called Camp Lawrence. It was a segregated camp at Great Lakes, and I went through 6 weeks of boot training over there. We marched and everything and went through the rigors of what we had to do in the Navy at the time. Now, the strange thing that happened was my mother's brother was a captain in the Navy, and he was the personnel officer. he found out I was there, sent for me. I wouldn't give him away, though. I just said, Uncle Charlie, don't worry about it.
And am I inferring correctly that he was Caucasian?
Yes, he was. See, there's my mother's picture over there. And my sister, yes.
So no one's putting it together that you two are related. He is your Caucasian uncle, that you're the only one who knows he's your uncle.
Yes. So I didn't say anything. And what he did, he put me in the Great Lakes Choir. I enjoyed that because I got liberty every weekend. We had to go into Chicago and practice and sing. We got on the radio and we'd sing all sorts of songs. Every Sunday we would sing with the Great Lakes Choir. And I did that until even through chorus school. Captain Hayes sent at the time, he said, Robert, I'm going to send you to chorus school. He said, matter of fact, we need about 20 some of you guys from Camp Lawrence to go to chorus school. So they gave us a test. 22 of us passed it, and we went to Navy chorus school and went 9 weeks of training at Great Lakes. And from there, they sent us to the Brooklyn Naval Hospital. They sent 10 of us there. Some of the other guys went to St. Albans to a hospital there for further training. Then things begin to happen right after that. I got used to the difference at Great Lakes. It wasn't that bad because we ate, we slept, we were clean, we had clean clothes. We could go into Chicago, went out on Liberty whenever we could, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, being 17 going on 18, what do you do? You you go look for girls and you drink some booze and then you just go dancing at the time. Duke Ellington and Lionel Hampton was playing Take the A-Train and Flying Home at the time. And that was the music. We didn't listen to Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller. We didn't like that kind of music. You couldn't dance to it right. We'd go into the State Theater and the Regal Theater in Chicago, and that's where I first learned about Ella Fitzgerald. She was singing there with a man named Chick Webb, a drummer. And we had a lot of fun in Chicago. But that broke up the monotony with the kinds of things we went through at Great Lakes. But anyway, from there, over at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital, that's another experience, a very traumatic experience. Segregation had backfired on the armed forces at the time. In 1942, Roosevelt integrated, said, put black Marines there. So they sent those men to Munford Point. Right. And the medical care, most of these guys were from the South, and they didn't get good medical care. And when they got to Munford Point, they were sick. Most of them were sick. They had worms. They had a whole bunch of other things wrong with them. The white corpsmen would not treat them. For anything they had, they gave them a Brown's mixture and cod oil. They had a broken arm. That's what they gave them. So they had to get some black corpsmen there. So 7 of us, when we finished training at the hospital, were sent to Munford Point. But my first experiences at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital, it was very traumatic because what they did with us, they put us to work in the kitchen. The first day we got there, we were assigned to kitchen duties, washing dishes and serving food. And we had the Red Crosses on our uniforms and all that. And an officer came down there, a commander, came down. He saw this. He says, are you guys corpsmen? We said, yes, sir. He said, you're not stewards, mates. What are you doing working in the kitchen? You belong up on the wards. So he went and got the chief petty officer in charge of us. What are these men doing in the kitchen? He said, sir, we can't send them up on the wards. They would interact with the white nurses up there. And that commander told that chief, he said, look, you get those men up on the wards now. He said, if you don't do it, I'm going to bust you down. He said, the lowest rank that one of those men have is a hospital apprentice, second class. I'm going to bust you down to that. So we went up on the wards. And when we went up on the wards, it was new training up there. Was up there 2 weeks. The first black Navy nurse came there. She was a full lieutenant, and she outranked most of the white nurses. And guess where they put her to work? In the linen room. So I went to work with Mrs. Daly, and we'd go out on liberty sometimes together. And she said, "You're not supposed to fraternize with officers, you know." I said, "Well, I'm not fraternizing with you. I'm just going out to New York with you." But because I had relatives in New York that I visited, and I had a good time in New York, going over to the Savoy and all that, listening to good music. Turned 18, I go into the bars. I could get a drink. They'd serve us because we were in uniform. Sure. I didn't say anything. But anyway, the experiences at that hospital, the way the seven of us that were there, see, there were only about 21, 22. Seven of us went to the hospital for surgical duties and field training for injuries that people would get in the field. And that's what I learned. Seven other guys went to the ships. I wanted to go to the ships. I wanted to go aboard the USS Mason or the US Pelican. That were all black Navy ships. I wanted to go on board one of those. But they wouldn't send me because they said I'm not old enough. They wanted guys in their 20s over there. So they sent me to the Marines. And that's when I left the Naval Hospital and went down to Mumford Point. That's where a whole lot of mess started.
Well, and to wrap up that discussion about Brooklyn Naval Hospital and the prejudice that you really experienced there, I'm just curious if what the effect of that was on you. Did it, because you can laugh about it now in retrospect, I don't think you're laughing too much then. Did it anger you? Did it motivate you to prove yourself every bit as patriotic and loyal as white soldiers were? What do you think the effect was on you?
Well, being in New York and having a lot of relatives there and also in Philadelphia, I was told to persevere through that. At the time, you had a man named Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP. You had A. Philip Randolph, very prominent black man at the time. And they formed an organization called the Double V for servicemen. And this was the sign, the Double V. And that is, we had a fight overseas and we had a fight at home. One was for prejudice here, discrimination and prejudice, and the other one was against the enemies of the United States. And we had to fight those two.
And the results of that fight would change generations to come. It's time for our first break, but we're going to hear more of Robert Hammond's story in a moment. Celebrating Black History Month on Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back after this.